Well, there's our final hour with Kevin Mitnick. I've got some more things to talk with him about that we'll get to your phone calls. And by the looks of things, lots of you have things to talk with Kevin about. So we'll be back in a moment with him and you on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Kevin Mitnick with us here. Kevin, I'm getting a lot of robocalls on my cell phone. What the heck is causing all this?
Well, the telemarketers, you know, find your cell phone number and just put you into their systems, and they automatically get calls. I get it all the time. What I subscribed to was an app, and I use an iPhone, in the Apple App Store. I think it was called Robocaller, and it dropped significantly, but still some come through.
Mm-hmm.
So what I end up doing is blocking them. If they turn out to be a real hassle, you know, that you can go on a website and put your number on the what you should do. One of the first things,
the do not disturb list, right? Yeah.
And add your number to it. But despite that, you still get these calls. And the app helped, and it reduced it significantly. That's what I suggest people do, is look into the mobile apps that they could obtain. One thing that people also should consider is everyone uses a mobile device. So mobile devices are a target-rich environment for the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Compromised.
Absolutely.
So there's an app out there called Secure NYC. And I know it works on iPhone because I have one. I'm pretty sure it's for Android. And a company, Zimperium, who is a leader in mobile security, had released this app publicly recently. And what this app does, it actually helps mitigate any bad actor from exploiting the software on your phone. And it's absolutely free. So you have nothing to lose.
Well, how do these app companies, Kevin, make money if they give you everything for free? What do they want?
Well, no, they sell their product to enterprises for big bucks. And probably they release this consumer version to either, again, gain PR out of it, or they felt it was the right thing to do.
Get the word out about it and stuff like that. What is the dark web, Kev?
Dark web is an area that that you could visit with a Tor browser. Tor was developed actually by the U.S. government, and it was a way to anonymize yourself on the internet, because it's extremely difficult to maintain anonymity on the internet. So what you could do is you could use your Tor browser and visit websites on the dark web. And of course, the dark web has a very negative image, because you have real bad guys that leverage the ability of maintaining anonymity to do real bad things and sell serious contraband, be it fake identities, drugs, guns. There's even hitmen that actually use the dark web to sell their services. So you have, you have the bad side of the dark web, but also you have a good side of, you know, imagine journalists or dissidents in countries like where they have censorship, like China, that want to be able to read Western news or to post an article on a blog and this sort of thing, so Tor could be used for a very positive thing. So anybody could go to Google Tor, T-O-R, and download the Tor browser. And unfortunately, it's not as easy to search for sites on the dark web as it is, you know, on the surface web and use Google, that sort of thing. But what at least you could do is, if you want to shop anonymously, you know, a lot of these sites out there track you. They track where you go because they want to, you know, advertise, send you advertisements, this sort of thing. So one way to stop that from happening is to use Tor when shopping online. Yeah. They'll have your name, they'll have your address, mm-hmm. they'll have your credit card number because you're buying product, but they won't have the ability to tie that to other sites that are in their network and that sort of thing.
Kevin's website, mitnicksecurity.com, linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. What I try to do when I buy stuff on the web is use a credit card with an intentional small line of credit just in case it gets taken. What do you think of that?
Yeah, and unfortunately, you have to think about this in brick and mortars, because what has been happening of late, well, actually for, you know, several years, is threat actors from Russia, for example, which have, you know, been indicted in most of these cases have installed malware, malicious software in, you know, brand name companies, big companies like Target, for example, and put the malware in their point of sale system. So imagine you walk into a Target or a Macy's and you swipe your credit card on their device. What the bad guys are able to do is steal your credit card data.
Jeez, and you think you're safe and everything else.
So what another recommendation you might want to consider is with your credit card company, you usually could access your credit card balance and do things online to look at your statement and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Is a lot of these credit cards have the ability to put alerts. So you could put an alert on your card that if a transaction takes place of more than $25, it sends you an SMS or sends you an email. And that's what I do. I have this on all my credit cards. So anytime my credit card is used, I know about it. So that way, if it's stolen, you know, if I used it at a Macy's, whatever, and the criminals got access to my card number, I would know about it immediately, can call the card company and cancel.
Good point. Let's take some calls here for you. We'll start by going to Nashville City, California. Richard's with us. Richard, you're on with Kevin Mitnick.
Hi, Richard.
Hi there, Rich.
Hi. My question is, I'm thinking about buying a computer, and which operating system is more secure from being hacked? Chrome, Windows, or Apple's OS?
Well, all of them could be hacked, but if you want to go for security, you know, again, when you increase your security, you reduce your convenience, I'd consider a Chromebook. That's more of a, that's a harder target to compromise.
What is a Chromebook, Kevin, for people who don't know?
Oh, a Chromebook is it's kind of a cheap laptop. From what I recall, you could buy them for like $200-$300, and it basically is an operating system where you can't really download applications to it. Basically, everything is, well, you can't, basically everything is controlled by Google. So basically, you have the Chrome browser and you have apps that you could, I believe, download from Google's App Store. I don't have a Chromebook, but I know of several enterprises that do. I don't actually use one personally, but when you have a model where you could only download applications that are signed by the vendor, like Apple with iOS and that sort of thing, I think that security model is better than antivirus software. So I'd consider getting a Chromebook if that's, you know, if you're just wanting to have a device, for example, just to access your financial accounts. That's separate from your. So one of the other considerations is to have a separate device, like a Google Chromebook or an iPad, to access your financial accounts, your brokerage accounts, your checking account, your credit card accounts, and never keep passwords to those accounts on your main computer, but only on the Chromebook in a password manager, for example. And then you're using a separate device to access your financial accounts, which are probably the most important to you. And yes, it's inconvenient because you're using a separate device on your main computer, but it increases the security of your financial account substantially. And of course, you want to enable two-factor authentication at all your financial sites, meaning what two-factor authentication is not only where you have to put in your username and password, but you might have an application on your phone. The site might push you a request saying, is this you? And you type yes, and it logs you in, or it might send you a text code over SMS. So by all means, you should always enable two-factor authentication at every website you can, especially if it's financial.
What is your ghost team? Tell us about them.
Well, it's my pen testers. So basically, I run a information security company that does security testing. So companies around the world hire the team to actually hack in, whether it's physically, whether it's to find, you know, security flaws in internet-facing web applications, whether it's to, you know, physically, you know, whether it's to compromise a wireless network on the company premises or their external network services. And well, we go in and simulate a bad actor. We simulate a threat actor and try to identify all the different ways and means of compromising the company. So now that we have this information, we could share with the company how we compromised it and what they need to do to fix it.
We're with Kevin Mitnick, the world's most famous hacker. Does that bother you when we say that, Kevin?
I think it's a media tagline. You know, like, well, it's better than saying one of the FBI's 10 most wanted.
That's true. I just know you're our friend. I don't want to offend you.
Yeah, of course. But, yeah, I mean, it's like I'm not the best hacker in the world. I'm sure, you know, there's, you know, that's just the title CNN gave me. I mean, you know, there's people with less skills and better skills than me. No one person can know everything, right? And I'm always learning from my colleagues in the area of information security. I'm learning new things, and I'm teaching other people things that they didn't know. So it's a very interesting community where you're always learning new stuff. So that's why doing a cybersecurity career is so challenging and interesting, and there's no monotony because everything changes every day.
Are some hackers making millions doing what they do?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the bad guys are making millions at what they do in fraud. So
yeah.
Basically, what happens now, you know, and this is, you know, and you've already mentioned ransomware on the show earlier, is ransomware is a huge problem. And this is where an attacker sends a phishing email, basically a bogus email to one of your users in your company, and your user thinks it's from a vendor. They go ahead and open it. It might have an attachment, and they click it. And what happens is it deploys ransomware in that enterprise network. And what the ransomware does is it encrypts all the files it has write access to, whether it's on a network share, whether it's on a local computer. And after it's done encrypting everything, then a message pops up on the victim's computer that, you know, all your files have been encrypted. If you want to get, you know, if you want to get access to your files back, you're going to have to send $1,000 worth of Bitcoin to this Bitcoin address and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So major companies have been compromised and victimized through ransomware, and it's a huge problem. I think to the tune of billions of dollars of loss.
Jeez.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
And now
it's like a new industry.
Yeah, now you got bad actors that go into companies, they steal sensitive databases, right, or their trade secrets. And if you remember, this happened to Uber, right? So Uber had was compromised by, I believe, these guys in the United States. I'm trying to recall the exact facts of the story. And they demanded that Uber pay them $100,000, I think, or more. It was in the six-figure range, or else they were going to release the database.
Huh.
And what had happened is Uber paid.
They paid it?
So they paid it.
Wow. Now, how do you hide a bank account? Because they're going to eventually know who you are.
Well, in this particular case, it was quite interesting because what Uber did is they classified this hack as a bug bounty. So what a bug bounty is a lot of companies are doing are participating in bug bounties, and this is where you give hackers permission to try to find security flaws, you know, in your internet-facing infrastructure, and if they find it, you reward them with some sort of monetary payment, right? So what companies do is they advertise, you know, like Google advertises, hey, if you can compromise us, you know, go ahead and try, and if you do it, let us know about it, and we'll pay you. Microsoft does it, all the big players. And what Uber did is they reclassified this hack as a bug bounty, and so the attackers gave their true identities and were paid, and then later on, I believe they were actually arrested. I'd have to go Google it to check it. So they didn't get away with it, but they almost did.
Let's go to Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Wayne, go ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad I got into you guys tonight.
Sure.
So, a couple ways the Koreans and the Chinese are getting this stuff.
How the Chinese are getting into American
systems? Yeah, how they're getting into this. What the Koreans were doing was having a Korean prostitution ring targeting the computer guys.
That's going to be it. No. What nation states are going to do is they're likely going to use spear phishing and or find a security flaw in a company's internet-facing application that is used to get to the internal network of the business or the critical infrastructure agency, that sort of thing. That's the most likely way of attack. And, of course, nation states, again, could develop or could purchase zero-day exploits, which are that's computer code that exploits a vulnerability that they do not report to the manufacturer of the software, like the operating system, like Windows or Apple or that sort of thing.
Do you think a company like WikiLeaks would be a recipient of, let's say, stolen emails, have a right to put them on?
I look at WikiLeaks, and I don't look at it as a company. I think it's really a news organization, and I don't view them any different than the New York Times. I mean, I think Rudy Giuliani just mentioned this as well in the press, is I consider, you know, while you might dislike Julian Assange and how he operates his news media organization, why I could understand that and how he kind of targets the United States in some regard because he might not like some of the political leaders, he still is acting as a news organization,
yep,
in my opinion, and is releasing newsworthy stories.
He's not making it up.
Or the New York Times would release. And, of course, he's not stealing the data. He's not conspiring with the bad actors to get the data. All that he's doing is publishing the data. And while he's publishing information that governments don't like, which I can completely understand, I don't think he's breaking the law. But then again, I'm not an attorney.
Right. Is he an enabler? Who knows?
I don't know. You know, you might have some fans of Julian that want to, you know, to impress Julian by maybe stealing some information that's, you know, interesting to his cause and giving it to him to publish. But you got to remember when Julian released the war logs in Afghanistan and the election emails from the Hillary Clinton campaign,
mm-hmm,
other news organizations jumped on the bandwagon and published the same story.
Oh, sure thing. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's newsworthy information. Of course, Julian has kind of poked the tiger and has done it in a way to really pee off the United States and the UK. And I believe that's why they're going to go after him and make his life miserable as it is now, where he's kind of held incommunicado in the Ecuadorian embassy.
Yeah. What about Edward Snowden?
He's a different story.
Yeah.
He was obviously working for the NSA as a contractor, so he had the obligation to obviously keep any information, you know, obviously secret. While I appreciate him letting the American public know that the government was eavesdropping on our communications without a warrant.
Illegally, you know, illegally, yeah.
Illegally, and I think that was important to know. So I think that was a public service, but I don't agree with the fact that he released our operations against foreign countries, like letting the public know, for example, that we were monitoring Angela Merkel's cell phone,
mm-hmm,
which is used in... Yeah, don't forget.
But that doesn't make it right. Monitoring Angela Merkel's cell phone doesn't make it right by us as a nation.
Right, but he still shouldn't have revealed that information. And I don't really know if he – I think he just copied the data and gave it to Glenn Greenwald,
mm-hmm,
and the news media.
Well, they ran with
it. I don't think he had the time to sit there and say, oh, this is a foreign op, this is a U.S. op, and actually distinguish. I think it was just, hey, in his opinion, the privacy of everyone in the entire world is at stake. There's no transparency, and he's just going to release everything.
Kevin, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Kevin Mitnick. Kevin, does a company know quickly that they've been hacked? How do they find out?
Usually when something bad happens, like one of the users reports they've been hit with ransomware or some of their data is leaked or someone, one of their defenders. Companies sometimes engage what they call blue teams, which are cybersecurity experts that are tasked with trying to find intrusions in the company's network, and they detect something. That's how some of these major data breaches were figured out, was through these defenders that were on the breached companies' networks. So that sort of thing. What's scary is in a lot of cases where, you know, like you were talking about critical infrastructure or even some big name enterprises, they realize when they go and look that there's already been a compromise.
What do you see in store in 2019 and beyond in the world of hacking?
Wow.
More sophistication?
Well, spear phishing, I think, is on the rise. In fact, I don't know if you know this, I'm the chief hacking officer of a company called KnowBefore. That's KnowBefore. And what our company is, and we're over 600 employees now, but our security awareness training is already at, you know, over 20,000 companies. They get to see my face actually on training videos and that sort of thing. And what is really cool is we offer this simulated phishing platform so companies could actually start phishing campaigns against their own employees.
Testing
them,
I guess.
Rather than getting ransomware, they'll get a message, hey, you made a mistake, you know, and
gotcha.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
That's cool. All right, back to the...
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Because I looked this up, and I don't know if this is you. Did you ever have a Gmail account?
Did I ever? Yes. Because of my phone.
George Norrie?
No.
Oh, okay. Because actually in the password leak database, there's a George Norrie at gmail.com that had a leaked password. I just wanted to make sure that wasn't you.
Yeah, that was not me. But there's an imposter that probably stole my name, right?
Oh, I get it all the time. I try to register at a lot of different public services like Gmail or whatever, and people have already stolen my name. Can't you?
Let's go to Jay in Minnesota. Welcome to the show. Go ahead, Jay.
Hey, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
What an educational show and a great guest. Mr. Mitnick, it's an honor. I read your book, The Art of Invisibility, and it really opened my eyes. I mean, I worked in IT for 10 years, and I was not prepared for the information that you revealed in that book. I feel like everybody should read this to understand, you know, the simplest of things that they, where they're vulnerable. And but I have a question. I'd just like to ask you, what do you think is perhaps one of the best or the best resource that you use for staying informed and up to date on emerging technologies and computer science?
Well, when it deals with information security, I follow a lot of the experts on Twitter. So I think that's a really good resource. In fact, Twitter is able to give me a lot of the information, like about, let's say, a security vulnerability or some new research that somebody has done. So I keep my ear close to the ground using Twitter as one of my primary resources. And of course, when somebody posts a tweet, it links to some article or maybe a data breach or some new exploitation technique or a new technique of how a company could better, or even a consumer could better, defend themselves against a cyber attack. So that's what I personally use. And if you're interested in following me on Twitter, my Twitter name is Kevin Mitnick, very easy. And I retweet a lot of the good articles that I find on Twitter.
How vulnerable is Facebook, Kevin?
Well, Facebook was recently compromised this year. And
right.
What the bad guy, well, what the people who are behind the attack figured out is actually how to use not users' usernames and passwords, but there's a technology that allows us to use tokens, and what the threat actors were able to do is use the tokens to gain access to targeted Facebook users. So Facebook also has suffered compromise, of course, with the Cambridge Analytica issue that was, you know, obviously in the press, and that's kind of huge news. So Facebook has some problems that they need to resolve.
Jeff in Santa Rosa, California. Jeffrey, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Good to hear you again.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Mr. Mitnick, Kevin Mitnick, you are an urban legend, and I am very honored to be speaking with you tonight. And I have two things that I would like to ask you. The first one is, if you and Fiber Optic, the other homegrown United States urban legend, would consider getting together and putting together a movie about your exploits and the things that you've done over the years so that it's not lost to history. I think it would be very interesting.
The Fiber Optic is a handle for a guy named Mark Abin. He was also a hacker who's also gone straight and who is well known. I haven't talked to Mark in quite some time. But the good news is I might there might be a new release where there might be a new movie based on my book Ghost in the Wires.
Cool.
Being done. So hopefully that will come to fruition. But yeah, I respect Mark and what he's done. And there was a prior movie about my exploits that wasn't true. It was not accurate at all, called Takedown. And now hopefully we could set the record straight and a feature film or a short TV series will be done on Ghost in the Wires.
And what else do you have, Jeff, for us?
The other thing is a FTP set. FTP site that I was looking for within the last week and a half or so. I just got tired of jumping through the hoops on the site, so I said, well, you know, I'll just check out this FTP site and see if I can get it that way through their public access server. So I typed in FTP site for whatever company it was. I don't even remember anymore. And I had fat fingers and hit a wrong switch on there somewhere. It was, one of the, like an apostrophe or whatever it was. And I ended up with websites that looked interesting, but wasn't what I was looking for. So I clicked on one of them, and I got this nice little sign that said, this is a restricted access web server, and if you don't have access for this, it's a fine and prison term and all that. And I went, well, you know, this is probably not something I want to look at, even though I had the files in front of me on my computer screen and access to the parent directory. So I clicked on another one that looked interesting. It wasn't what I was looking for, but, you know, what's this? It was on the start page. I was using their server. And I got another government access site. And after about the third or fourth one, I went, you know, something is not right here. And I got off of it right away. So I was wondering if that kind of access to government servers is actually legal or not. I mean, if it's normal, because I've never run into it before, and I didn't realize it was a .gov web server until I actually started looking at the addresses instead of the title.
Well, it's quite strange that they'd have FTP access to a government server these days.
Right.
That's really odd. But if you don't have authorization to access any computer, I'd stay away from it. I've been down that path, and it didn't work out too well for me back in those days. So make sure when you're accessing any system that you have authorization first.
Kevin, who is QAnon? Why can't they find this group or this person?
QAnon?
QAnon.
I haven't heard of them.
Really?
I've heard of them.
Yeah, they
Google it.
They post a whole bunch of stuff about the deep state. QAnon.
I heard of it, but I didn't actually...
Yeah, check into that.
But look into it. So I don't have the answer for you now.
How can somebody go online and not be discovered where they're originating from? How do you hide that?
Well, remember earlier in the show we talked about Tor, and Tor is it's one of the mechanisms to access the dark web, but it's also a mechanism to maintain anonymity.
Uh-huh.
So, but people think that Tor is 100% safe. I would suspect intelligence agencies have techniques and tactics that could be used to unmask a Tor user. If you recall, I don't know if you recall this case of Silk Road. It was run by this guy named Ross Ulbricht, and he was so dependent. He bet his life on it. He essentially bet his life that the U.S. government would never be able to track the real IP address of his server, and they eventually did, by exploiting a software flaw in it and tracked it to Iceland. And now, unfortunately, he's sitting in prison for life without parole.
Jeez.
You can't bet your life on it. There's always a way to de-anonymize you. But that's one of the mechanisms. If you're doing something, you know, you're a straight shooter, you're doing something legal, you could always use Tor to anonymize your activity.
Elisa's back with us in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Elisa.
Hi, George. Be careful of those clowns on the deep web.
We don't want those clowns, that's for sure.
So, okay, a couple things. There's a free app, iOS and Google Play. It's called Truecaller, and it's free. And I have that on my phone. I haven't had a spam call since May.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so I'm going to look into that. And then, Kev, so I just was wanting to know your thoughts on the many shoes that keep washing up, complete with foot intact. Matter of fact, we just had a tennis shoe washed up yesterday at Cannon Beach, Oregon. Bigfoot inside of Tennessee.
Oh, yeah, they've been coming up on British Columbia and everything out there, mm-hmm. haven't they?
Is that related to the dark web?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you can answer that, Kevin.
Yeah, I would have no idea.
There are feet. Body parts have been showing. Feet and lots of feet, sometimes with shoes on, believe it or not. Weird. Okay, Lisa, that's worth checking into, though, I think. Kevin's not the one, but that's a great story. Joe in Long Island, New York. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, hello. Kevin, great show. I just heard in the last couple of days about people with credit cards in their wallets can actually have them hacked as they're a pedestrian by somebody walking nearby and that they're selling wallets to help protect against this. Have you heard of this? Is this possible?
Oh, yeah, that's possible. There's a little machine that they can scan through and grab it. Go ahead, Kev.
Like grab what, your credit card or some other, or your proximity access card? A credit card, they're not going to be able to gain that data remotely unless it... Now, some of those, your credit cards have PayPass, but you'd have to get extremely close to a victim's credit card. But typically, when we're doing physical security engagements, which means companies hire us to physically break in, a lot of companies use access control cards, meaning you have to have a badge or a card to get into the building. Well, one of our common techniques is we have devices or build devices where we're able to get within 3 feet of a victim and covertly read the information off the card that allows us to clone the card and gain access to the building as that particular victim, which is very common.
We go to Tin now in Alabama. Hello, Tin.
Good morning.
Good
I want to ask
us
a couple questions right quick.
Sure.
One is about debit cards and the safety tips that you can recommend for using it when you're out in public. And then also I would like some tips on what to do with old mail that has accumulated and does shredding actually eliminate, you know, threats. And I'll take my answer.
Okay, let's start with the debit cards. I don't like using the debit card in public, Kevin. And, you know, if you get hacked, it takes a while to get your money back. It's a mess.
Agreed. Yeah. I agree with you, George. I don't use a debit card for what I do personally. Just use it for ATM. That's it. I never use my debit card for anything else, especially online, because as George just said, it's a hassle to get your money back, and there's a time lag. With a credit card, which is the best payment device to use online or, you know, out in the public, because if there's fraud, at least in the United States, the bank immediately credits your account, and if it's deemed to be fraud, it's immediately removed. No hassle, no problem.
Exactly, exactly. And you're not screwed up that much. In terms of shredding mail, what do you think? What do you recommend?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, if any of your physical documents have confidential data on them, I'd use a cross shredder rather than the strip shredder that you could put together. Like, you know, a 14-year-old with enough time puts it together like a jigsaw puzzle, but I'd use a cross shredder and go ahead and shred it.
You know, Kevin, as we wrap things up here, as technology gets better and better and better, are the cyber criminals going to get better and better and better too?
Yeah, it's constantly. Don't forget, as all our technology becomes more complex in nature, you know, mobile phones, tablets, communication, network communications, now we're moving over to 5G. As computers are growing, so does the complexity. And when you have complexity, there's obviously lots of security vulnerability. So there will always be the threat actors that find and exploit those security vulnerabilities. And that's why it's so important as a consumer or as a person to actually stay ahead and keep up with it and follow what we call best security practices to mitigate the chance that you're going to become the next victim.
When you hacked, was it a rush for you?
Oh, yeah. It was for the challenge. It was the seduction of adventure. It was the entertainment. Again, it was like a computer game. And insanely enough, when I was evading the FBI and I was a fugitive, I treated the situation and don't laugh, George, like I was an undercover operative. That I wasn't really running from the government, but I put myself in this fake state of mind to be able to cope with the everyday situation. Because if you're looking over your shoulder and know that the government's chasing you and you're always on the run, it's not a great lifestyle. But if you could gamify it and say, oh, I'm an undercover operative in this game, then it becomes livable.
It sure does. Kevin, thank you. Enjoy the rest of your vacation in Australia. Up next, the science of the paranormal.